Hi, friends. I'm Shirley, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, my sobriety date is April 15th, 1986, and for that, like a lot of you, I am just incredibly grateful. My life is, like George said, like Harris said, has changed a lot, and I'll try and share a little bit of that with you, that part of what it was like. Hope I don't get hung up a little too much there. Sometimes I do. What happened and what it's like now, because today, man, today is good for me, you know. Anyway, a big part of that is the fact that I have a home here, and it started after some of the details I'll get into later, but it started with a home group, and my home group is Greater Kearns Group. We meet Monday nights at 8:30 in what used to be Kearns, Utah, Salt Lake, essentially, and out in West Valley. And those people accept me, and some say that they love me just the way I am. And that's something that a lot of people that were real close to different places I called home over the years couldn't quite do, probably because I wasn't quite lovable, and they weren't sick enough to need to love me. Like you, some of you guys are sick enough to even need to love somebody like me, you know. Anyway, I have to make like a little confession thing, you know, that admit, you know, our faults and all that kind of stuff, and like correct it quickly. Some of that stuff that again George was talking about in those steps that we have to learn to do. And I had this thought as we were walking out last night. And I actually had it on Friday night, too. And the thought went through my head of, man, what an act to follow when I listened to Chris and to Mike on Friday. And then last night, as I listened to my husband, Mike, share, I thought, and we were walking down that little ramp outside, and I thought, oh, man, what an act to have to follow. You know, and then that part came to me of, hey, dummy, it wasn't an act. You know, this is who these people really are, you know, and what a gift that is, because that's who we get to be here, is who we are and who you guys turn us in to be. You know, we're all doing that for each other every day. Anyway, I grew up in Utah in a little town called Richfield, just down the road, and spent my first 18 years there and escaped the second I could. To what I thought was going to be a bigger, better, badder place, you know, of Salt Lake City, where I've essentially, except for a, you know, a couple of times I ran away from home, as an adult, I've lived in Salt Lake since. I guess I'll start first by a couple of things that I'm going to share in my story today are parts that those of you who've heard me share before probably heard, but they're the parts that I have to remember for me in order for me to remember exactly who I was, exactly where I came from, and how you guys gave me the gift of life to stay here. So the first that I had my visual, my tangible part of recognizing what alcoholism is, I was 17 years old. And it's not that I wasn't around alcoholics. I lived with an alcoholic. You know, on my dad's side, my whole family was alcoholic. It's just kind of like how it was. That's especially the men. That's what men were drunks. And I understand that today. I fell in love with them then, and I always have loved drunks. For if nothing else, that they're a good person to blame stuff on, you know? And you can hide behind that a lot, you know? Good drunken man is something you need in every life. So, but anyway, when I was 17, we got a phone call at our house one night, and it was from the neighbors of my uncle, my dad's brother. And they hadn't heard anything from him for a couple of days in the apartment that he was living in, and they were concerned about him, and they called my dad to come check on him. Well, the problem that my dad had that day was the same problem he had every day at that time, which was he couldn't drive. And so I was elected to drive him up there, and we went in to that apartment, and that was where I first smelled this disease, because it has a smell. It has a flavor that sticks on your tongue, and it smells like urine, and it smells like feces. It smells like a stale room and stale smoke and stale booze. And that's what alcoholism smells like. And I knew it, and I felt it. And I got to tell you, just sitting here trying to describe it to you guys today, which I'm sure some of you know the smell, that smell of death, that part that alcoholism can take some of us to, I can taste it on the back of my tongue today. And that's good for me to remember, because I know it was in my future had you guys not got hold of me first. But we went there, and this uncle of mine that I had loved all my life was comatose, and we took him up to the hospital. And the doctors gave my dad, who was standing there holding one eye like this, you know, trying to focus in on what was going on, he gave him since he was next of kin, asked him about life support and things like that. And my dad said, "Now, you know, that's not what we would want." And they had told him they'd only probably be able to keep him alive for a couple of days anyway, that stuff was done. And, you know, we walked out of that hospital with sadness. And we got in the car, and my dad and I had a profound exchange, one that I wouldn't have dared do before, and I certainly wouldn't have dared do after, because you didn't speak up or talk back to my dad. And I had learned that since I was 2 or 3. But we sat there in the car, and our car was a two-bottle car. There was a half pint under this side, under the driver's side, and there was a half pint under the passenger side. And since I was driving, my dad reached for the passenger pint. And he always did this one thing. You know those visuals that you never forget? You know, those slow-motion things that you always remember. And I remember my dad taking that bottle, and he always drank straight out of the bottle, and he untook the cap, and he did the wipe the lid of the bottle off, you know, like he just shared it with the guy in the park next to him, you know, that kind of wipe, and wiped it off, and he's standing there, and he's having this thought, and he shared it with me and whoever was in his mind at the time, and he said, "The son of a bitch, the dumb, stupid son of a bitch, couldn't he see what he was doing to himself?" And before he could get the bottle to his mouth was when he and I had an interaction. And I grabbed the bottle out of his hand and I threw it past him and out the window. And I used those same words again. And I said, "You are the dumb son of a bitch. Can't you see you are exactly like him?" And he didn't hit me or nothing. You know? But he sat there and, you know, we just drove home, and I don't remember any other conversation. But what happened right after that is we, you know, had the funeral stuff and all those kinds of things, and I had a few cousins in town who were a lot like me, and that part that was a lot like me that I hadn't shared yet was I was a drunk, you know. And when we had this funeral, I never drank at home. It's not something you did, you know. I mean, it just wasn't. So I and a couple of my friends had gone out, and we'd rented a motel room, so that myself, my cousins, and my friends could go and celebrate and mourn the death of my uncle by getting drunk. And I got to tell you, that made perfectly good sense to me. I wasn't at all like my uncle, and I wasn't at all like my dad. I was just doing what came naturally, which was drinking over a sorrow. I mean, it was legitimate for me, you know, and it was normal for me. I couldn't see at all that I was just exactly like them. And I was. The second part of that whole deal that happened in that week, because it meant stuck so much in me, was I saw how bad things could be, and I knew it wasn't me. I mean, for one thing, they were old, you know. And certainly that makes a difference. And you know that part where you don't think you're ever going to get old anyway, so it's like it doesn't really matter. But at this man's funeral, he was eulogized by a man who had been his best friend for years. And this particular man had gotten sober and found sobriety through Alcoholics Anonymous had changed his life and everything was better. You know, and that's all fine and dandy, but what he did from the podium in this church when my uncle died was shared with the crowd there that my uncle didn't have to die had he found AA. There was a better way of life, and it was too bad he was a drunk. You know, that was the part that I heard. Now, he may have said other stuff, but what I heard was that there was this guy who somehow was better than all the rest of all these people and was shaming this family. That's what I heard that AA was. And fortunately, I know today that that's not exactly how it was. And maybe that's what maybe that's not even close to what he said. Maybe it's just what I had to hear from my own insulation of protection from my alcoholism. I don't know, but it put another taste in my mouth. Not of alcoholism, but of that possible recovery that I didn't want any part of later. Anyway, within the next year or so, I escaped that small town and moved to Salt Lake to bigger and better things and you know, on my own and living in an apartment with my sis part of the time and then through a number of roommates. And, you know, drinking was all part of just the natural act of things. And most of the time, it was fun. And most of the time, it was harmless. And, you know, there were a few times when I remember struggling when I get home from being out at night and I'd have to go from my car into my house and this one place had a rose bush in the backyard and I'd fight with that rose bush on numerous occasions just trying to get in the door and I'd come in and I'd be all scraped up and I tried to figure out what happened to me and it was like, oh, I had a fight with the rose bush just trying to get past the door. You know, I don't know how come things like that happened to me, but they did. You know, I listened to Mike's show last night, and he was, those of you who were here heard about the fact that he loved to drink, and he was behind the wheel of a car, and a lot, and so was I. I can't tell you why I always had to have some place to go, and I always had to have a way to go by myself, and I always had to have an escape route. You know, we talk to new people in AA now a lot of times and say, you know, if you're going to some place where you think you might be uncomfortable, make sure you have your own transportation home so you don't get stuck, you don't have to stay in any kind of slippery place. Well, that came real natural to me because when I would go out before, even part of the time when I was married, I took my own car so I could leave once I got mad, you know, because I knew I was going to get mad. You know, and I knew I was going to pick someplace else to go that didn't have anything to do with the particular person that I was married to or going home with, possibly. So, but most of the time, it was fun for a while. When I hit closer in my early 20s, life started just getting tougher. I started making worse choices. And it seemed like, in listening to people's stories over the years, what I hear from men a lot of times is that they went out and picked fights. That's what they did when they were drinking. Well, my deal when I went out drinking and even when I wasn't drinking was I picked people who liked to fight even if I wasn't. In other words, I found people, men in particular, who would treat me exactly the way I thought I deserved to be treated. And that was in, you know, neglectful, abusive, physical, those kinds of things. I mean, that's who I looked for. It was what I was used to in my life as a child, and it's what I was comfortable with. Didn't mean I liked it, just meant it was what I knew, and I went and found it. And I can tell you that there were a couple of cases where I met men in my life, and in fact, my third husband was not a physical abuser when I met him, but he was by the time I was done with him. You know, I mean, that's how sick some of us can be. You know, it's just, you know, we can train people. If they're as sick as us, we can train them to do what we need them to do. You know? Anyway, I got married when I was 21. And I got married when I was 21 because I was 21. I had been going with a guy for quite a while and I was 20, and it was like December, and I was going to be 21 in January, and I says, well, we got to get married. He said, why? why? You know, a little panic there. And I said, because I'm going to be 21. He said, I don't understand. I said, well, yeah, I just got to do it. And he said, well, not with me. Thank you very much. And so off he went, and that was like the end of December, and I got married on March 6th to a fellow I hadn't met at the time that I had that discussion. And I did that because it was the thing that I thought I had to do to be okay. And naturally, any smart, upstanding, ethical, sober person's not going to buy into that crap with me. So I picked one of the people that could probably qualify quite easily for a chair in this room, somebody who was drunk enough to marry me just because I was going to be 21. So that I remember standing on the courthouse steps in Elko, Nevada, and calling my dad because I figured, you know, I was his youngest child and I needed to share with him this glorious moment. And, well, Dad, I'm getting, you know, doing that kind of thing. I'm going to get married. But deep down inside, I knew he was going to tell me, no, dear, this is a mistake. Come home. And when I called him from those stairs and in my little drunken, I'd already been drinking the champagne ahead of time, stupor, he said, well, good luck. And I had no choice but to go inside and get married to this man I didn't know. I mean, that's how logical and, well, how foggy my thinking was. And that lasted for about a year. But it was like pretend existence. It wasn't like I was really in a marriage. It wasn't like I was really in a relationship. I was just pretending somehow to be a grown-up and pretending somehow to live in this life and to work a job and all that kind of stuff, because I got to tell you, deep down inside, I don't think I felt anything. You know, I was just empty. You know, well, naturally that went the way of any kind of logical, wise, placed decision and went down the road. And but not to be outdone, I thought, well, if that one didn't work, certainly I can try again. So within just a very short period of time, months, if you will, I was ready to do that same thing again. Again with somebody I didn't know, with somebody I didn't love, with somebody who was like us as far as drinking, but someone who had that abusive part down pat. And, you know, I walked into that with my eyes wide open, knowing that I was getting exactly what I was looking for and what I deserved. You know, and there were times in there that I had these moments of clarity that said, what are you doing here, girl? This is not your life. Your life doesn't have to be this. But it was, and it was because of all the choices I was making. And through that marriage, there was a child, you know, absolutely love her today. She's almost, she'll be 30 this year, and truly a gift from my heart. And but at that point in time, there was a little problem in the mothering part. It's like it's real tough to show love to a child and show caring to a child when you're so cold and dead inside. And when I escaped from, and that's truly what it ended up being, and when I escaped from that marriage, I was on my own and single with this little girl. And I have to tell you that if it wasn't for people who I can truly still call friends today, I don't know what kind of existence she would have had, because she had me. And as much as I wanted to be a good mom, it was much easier in some ways for her to be at the babysitter's and to spend someplace else for the weekend or something like that. And, you know, this one time, I took her over to a new place. I called a girlfriend of mine, and I, you know, the normal babysitter stuff wasn't working. And I had this big night out at the local beer place that I had to get to. I mean, it was a dart tournament. And you know how that important that is. And so, well, you know. Anyway, so I took my little girl over to a friend of a friend. And it was a part of town I had never been in. But they seemed like nice people. And they took my little girl who was, you know, I mean, she wasn't walking. She was still carrying size. And I took her over there and I left her for the evening. And I went out and I partied and I did the stuff I was going to do. And I went back to get her, and they had moved the neighborhood. It wasn't just the house. The whole subdivision was gone. And I drove around and around and around, and I was just crazed. I couldn't, all of a sudden, all the motherly instinct in the world was peak, and I couldn't find my baby. And they had kidnapped her, they had taken her, they had wiped the slate clean, and I was hysterical. And I went to a grocery store that wasn't too far from where I knew that she had been, and I started making phone calls. I was trying to use a stupid payphone, and the phone was against me too. It wouldn't let my calls go through. It just kept like a dial tone, no matter how many times I tried to make that call. And finally, I went up to the manager, and I was explaining, the night manager, I was explaining to him how this world was against me, how the payphones wouldn't even work, and I needed to find my daughter, and they'd moved the neighborhood, and the house was gone. You know, anyway, finally he let me use the phone at the desk, and I called my girlfriend who had arranged this whole thing. And she said, "Shirley, would you like me to come and get your daughter?" I said, "No, I just want to know where they took her." You know, finally she explained to me one more time how to get to the subdivision. By the time she explained it again and I got there, they had returned it. The house was back. You know, but I was so scared. I was so afraid. You know, and I knew I was wrong. I knew she would not be in this dangerous place had I not been drinking. And the next day, in my jeans, I had pennies in my pocket. And you know, they don't work in a payphone. You know, I was like, felt really dumb about that. But I learned a lesson that night. And I learned a lesson that I carried for a long time, and that was I didn't learn not to drink. I didn't learn not to do a whole lot of things that might have been a logical choice. But what I did learn was never, ever, ever take my daughter to someone's house I didn't know. If I couldn't get a good babysitter, I'd bring somebody to my house. At least I knew where that was. And that was how I solved that problem. It wasn't any major change in your behavior. You know how it gets in your life when you start having to change all your behavior so it can cycle around having the ability to and the opportunity to drink? You know, we quit going to those places where it's not allowed, you know. And, you know, I mean, if they would not have let me take mini bottles in my purse in the theater, I would not have gone to the theater. I mean, you know, it's just things like that. We just find ways to get around stuff. Well, and one of them had to do with her and making sure she was safe at home. But she wasn't safe from me, and neither was anybody else. I heard again, Mike talking about car wrecks last night. That was part of my deal. You know, driving and driving drunk and bumping things. Just minor bumps, you know. Just a little thing, like a fender or two, and yours or mine, you know, it wasn't like a big deal. When the same child went through driver's ed, when she turned 15 and a half or 16, whatever it was, she came home one day and she was livid. And she says, "I get it." And I said, "What do you get?" She says, "Now I know." I said, "What?" She says, "Why the car's corners on your car were always shiny." I said, "What do you mean, always shiny?" And she says, "They were always in the repair shop. All the, you know, the fenders on your car. You were driving drunk." Oh, well, and I was sober then, so it's like, yeah, I had to fess up to that. But there was a point in time in my life where the gal who owned the bar that I went to most, her husband was auto body guy, and we joked about the fact it was like having an attorney on retainer. He was my auto body guy on retainer, you know, and he just kept the painted stuck. But, you know, I don't know which one of you guys' cars it was that I was parking next to, but sorry about that. You know, I always blamed it on the basket in the supermarket. You know, well, I was just parked in the parking lot and some basket rolled across and hit me. Oh, yeah, what's the red paint, you know? But, you know, that some of those things are just too logical to have to look at. When I was 27, life had gotten so absolutely crazy. I was single again. I was living by myself with this child who was about 2 then, and I ran away from home. And the crazy part about that was I was living alone. Was my own home. And yet I still ran away. And I ended up It was logical at the time, you know. But I'm not real sure right now why it was I felt such a need to leave, but there was one. Real or imagined? Do you have any of those real or imagined things? Those imagined ones were the ones that used to get me a lot. But I ended up, and I can't explain why, but I ended up in Tulsa, Oklahoma, which is a little far away from Salt Lake to just kind of like end up there. But I ended up in this place that was a little room, because I had no money by the time I got there. I had a car and the stuff that was in it. And I ended up in this little room apartment that was $15 a week, had all the bugs you could eat. I made a mistake of going and buying a can of Raid because there were too many bugs, and I sprayed it around the floorboards. That's a mistake, because they had these beetly-looking things with hard backs on them. And so, like, during the night, you'd lay there and you'd hear. As they'd climb up the wall and crash, you know, and it was like, oh, man. But the place was so grimy and so dirty and so dilapidated that this little girl that I had with me, I wouldn't let her walk on the floor. You know, she just learned to walk, and she was, like, all over. But she was forbidden to walk in the house. I'd pick her up and move her from place to place where I thought it was clean enough. And I was working, like I said, I was broke. So I was working, doing a day labor job where I got paid every day. And to supplement that and to be able to feed her and be able to, you know, have sufficient amount of alcohol to deal with all life was going on, I did the weekly stop at the plasma center. And they had a deal where if you came in twice in a week, you got an extra shot of money, you know, you get a little extra for the second time. And, you know, it kept us so we were okay. Kept us in diapers and all that. But I was working this job that was like, I'd have to get up like 4 o'clock in the morning and go make toast at a hospital. I mean, this is what my life had come to. My job was to pick the toast up, put it in this toaster, watch it go down to the bottom, take it off and put it on a plate. They didn't let me butter it, you know. But I was like disoriented at night and living in this little place. And my daughter, because of all the turmoil that's going on, went back to needing diapers that she had been potty trained from. And so I was back doing these cloth diaper things. And she'd wake up in the night and need to go to the bathroom. Had gone to the bathroom in her diaper. So I'd lay there in bed with my eyes closed and change the diaper and put the dirty one on the plain concrete floor that was there and go back to sleep for a couple of hours or pass out for a couple of hours, whichever that case may be. And sometimes I get up in the morning and I think, you know, I thought I changed her last night. But there was no diaper, so obviously I hadn't. I was just dreaming. And then this one night, I woke up in the middle of the night, changed her diaper, I put it down, I went to go back to sleep when I needed to get up and go to the bathroom. And I got up just in time to flip the light on and see her diaper go underneath the bathtub, through the hole in the wall, where the rats lived. You know? And that bothered me. Somehow it felt like I wasn't doing the best for me and my family, you know. But what did I do? I didn't just stand there and go, oh no, I fought for that diaper. I dove underneath the tub and I'm sitting there talking about it. But there, you know, I mean, I haven't seen rats that tall for eyes that stood that far off the ground before. Nor again, nor do I ever want to. I just know what they look like when I'm down there having this intense tug of war underneath the bathtub on those little legs. You know, something's wrong with that picture. And I called my brother and I said, man, you know, I've made a major mistake here. Can you help me? And he says, I'll mail you some money. And I says, no. Mel won't do it, you know. So he went to Western Union, and he sent me some money, and I got in the car, and I came home, and moved back to Salt Lake again after a couple of weeks, and it was like, okay, stuff's going to be different. And, you know, it was exactly the same, because I was exactly the same. What I did do is I got married for a third time, and married... who was the fellow at the time was my best drinking partner. And he was just as sick as I was. And And he treated me the way I needed to be treated once he was trained to treat me the way he was supposed to. And we were married for just a little under 10 years. And I was still in that marriage and doing a bunch of things that were not healthy when I got sick enough to come see you guys, you know, because you're kind of sick. But we did the part of we got a house and we started getting some financial stuff together. And I was doing a job that I was in for quite a while. Can't tell you how that worked, but it did. But I was to a place where I was at that part where I was maintenance drinking for the most part. It was no longer the big party time. It was, I didn't have to drink in the morning like some of you guys, because I wasn't like that. But I did have the opportunity to go have cocktails at lunch and then maybe bring one back to have on my desk in the afternoon and then enjoy the camaraderie after work from 5 until about 11 at the local place. And I remember one time coming, we'd been there from like 5 o'clock to 11 o'clock and it was like time to go home and I was learning to drive like my dad, like this, you know, with the one eye open. If you hold this eyebrow up, it keeps this eye open so you can see to drive. And I'm driving down the road, and it happened to be exactly in front of where I'd worked for like about 10 years at that time. And I got stopped by the police. And I thought, oh man, what a way to go. Right in front of my office building. And so they have the lights going, and it wasn't like that was the first time I'd been stopped, and it wasn't like it was the first sobriety test that somebody had offered to let me try. I had never gotten a DUI. I can't tell you why. Didn't mean I didn't deserve it. You know, the one time when I got stopped and I had a carload of kids and I got sick on the officer's feet. I don't know why he didn't lock me up. The only thing I can figure out was he was close to the end of his shift and he wanted clean shoes. That's all I know, you know. I wrecked a car one time and wrapped it with a new car, 1984 Camaro, and it was hot, you know, T-top, and it was pretty, and it was this real dark cobalt gray color. And I wrapped a 35-foot of chain-link fence around it as I took through this one guy's parking lot when I took a nap on my way home one night. And the officers, when they came there, they said, my ex was with me, and he was standing there doing that kind of, you know how we stand when we got our feet too close together, and we're still trying to maintain balance, and you go in the you do the rotating motion thing, you know. And he was doing that, and this officer looks at me, and he says, I don't know why you're doing it, lady. I wouldn't take the fall for him. You know? Don't tell me you're driving. And I said, but I was. And I was, you know? But there for a moment, you know, kind of would have been a nice thought to just say, yeah, that sucker shouldn't have drove like that. Put my life at risk. And the reality was, one of the posts that had gone through the windows, because it knocked out all the windows but one in the car, one of them had just gone just barely past his head. And I told him later, you mess with me again next time, I will pop your head off. You know, so I was like, I was so gracious and kind. But anyway, back to the thing where I was at work. They stopped me and the cops got out, and I have no doubt that that time I was not going to get away. This guy, the officer driving the car, he looked real serious about this driving drunk stuff. And got out of the car, he ordered me out, and I'm standing there, and his partner got out of the car and come walking around, and I looked at him and I thought, oh, I know you. And he'd been to a party with a group of us the week before, and while some other folks were playing poker, he and I had gone out, and I went out and talked to him while he was having a joint. And so when I recognized him, I said, I remember you. You're a friend of so-and-so's, and I saw you last week. He said, you know, I think we ought to give this girl a chance. You know, let's get her a ride home. You know, and they pulled my car into the parking lot where I worked. Oh, how embarrassing. And they had me call a cab so I could take a ride home. And it cost me something like $22 for a cab. And I got to tell you, the next day, I was just livid. They had wasted $22 of my money by making me take a cab home. You know, I did not consider what it would have cost me to go to jail, what it would have cost me for an attorney, what it would cost me when I lost my license, what it would have cost me had I killed somebody. You know, I didn't consider any of those things, but that $22, I was irritated. You know, and I stayed that way for years. You know, I was just like, they're picking on me. You know, don't they know? Don't they get it? Don't they understand who I am? You know? And I was at the same job when I was there one day, and I went to walk out after work, and I hadn't had a drink since lunch. And I usually did in the afternoon. I'd have there at the end, I'd have something to coast through the afternoon. And like I said, I never drank in the morning, but I always took a drink to bed with me. If any of you ever did that, if you take like a 2 or 3 finger shot to bed with you, you can wake up during the middle of the night, have a couple of shots about 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, and you don't have a hangover in the morning. You also don't drink in the morning because it's technically night. You know, but worked for me. Anyway, so that's how my life had been the last couple of years. And I walked out of work, and I went to get in my car, and I was so cold, and I was shaking so hard and so bad, and I had to have a drink, and I didn't have one, and I couldn't go get one. You know, you've been there? You absolutely know that you're just going to die. And somebody said it one time from a podium, and I heard them. They likened it to a guy who's in the gas chamber. And somebody just dropped the pellet. And you know, you got to breathe to live. And you know, if you breathe in, you're going to die. You know, and that's how I was that afternoon. I knew I had to have a drink. And if I didn't get a drink, I was going to die. And if I did get a drink, I'd die. Well, that wasn't enough pain for me that day. I ended up finding my way to the liquor store. I ended up drinking for another probably year or so. But I still, when I go back to the place where I know that I started to crack apart and all the things outside started to crumble, that was my day. Sometime later, I had always prided myself on the fact that I had never missed a day's work. You know, I'd never missed a day's work for drinking, never missed a day's work for having a hangover. You know, I just never missed a day's work. It didn't mean I always did a good day's work or a full day's work or an honest day's work. None of that was on my measuring scale. It was just that I'd shown up. And this one day, I couldn't get up. I couldn't get out of bed. I couldn't open my eyes. I was just absolutely broken. And, you know, I have thought a lot of times about those of you, there's enough of you in here that are old enough to remember the show Laugh-In. Remember the guy on the tricycle? And he'd be riding along on his tricycle really, really fast, and he'd tip over. That happened to me that day. My trike tipped, and I crashed, and I broke, and I was absolutely broken apart. And I was so full of fear, and I had no hope. And, you know, the day before, I didn't have a choice whether or not to take a drink. I had to, just to live. But that day, I don't know what happened that day other than God's grace. I didn't take a drink that morning. I was so afraid and so broken and so scared, but I still didn't take a drink. And it wasn't something that was an option. It wasn't what I needed. I didn't know what it was I needed, but that wasn't it. And I knew that I was crazy, absolutely insane. That's the part that I knew. I didn't really tie it to the fact that I was an alcoholic, because I know how you guys are, and I wasn't like you particularly. Was different and special. But what I knew was I was insane. And all I had to do was look at my behavior to know that. It was real clear. And so I went and I asked for some help. And I went back to a fellow who was a marriage counselor. And I'd known him for 13 years. And we had been through 3 marriages together. And I kept going back to the same marriage counselor because he knew my half of the story already. You know, so there was no point in, like, rehashing this. And it was going to go my way that way. And all we had to do was focus on him, who was the problem anyway. And whoever him was. And I went to this guy, and he was trying to help me, and he knew I was truly in trouble, and that we weren't just talking the run-of-the-mill, you know, marital bliss-ending type thing. And he was trying to find a hospital for me because I truly was in bad shape, and lined me up with a meeting with a psychiatrist and stuff to get all that taken care of and see what they could do to get me in a safe place. But before that all came together, I had one more moment of clarity. And I went to this man and I told him, you know, we need to talk about one more thing about me. And he said, what's that? And I said, I'm an alcoholic and I need help. And this guy, you know, as good as he was and as much as he helped me through so many other things, just kind of laughed and said, truly, you marry alcoholics, you know. You have to drink to be the alcoholic. And you know, in all those years that we were talking to, we never once focused on my drinking. You know, it was always their problem, you know. And this man looked at me and he said, you know, much as I'd like to help you, I can't. You know, but I know who can. And he sent me to you guys. And he said, you know, go to AA, try it, you'll find some people there that when you look at them and you tell them this stuff, they're going to tell you you're full of crap because, you know, they're going to get it. And so I called this guy that I had worked for years before, who when I worked for him had 18 years of sobriety, which I thought was like a bunch of hooey, and who would want to do that? And what's your point? I mean, what's, you know. Anyway, so I called him and I said, you know, that the deal that you used to be involved in, that organization thing, and he said, and this little smart aleck, the Rotary? No. You know? And he says, oh, AA? And I said, Jen. He says, oh. He just kind of laughed. He says, who are you married to now? And I said, no, it's for me. And he said, good. You know? I mean, it's like when I was working for him, I was going out for beers at lunch. You think this guy didn't know? You know? But I knew I was different. I knew I was, you know, pulling them all over somebody's eyes. Yeah, right, like you couldn't smell that 3 or 4 cans of beer I had over lunch hour. But anyway, he got me the address of a meeting for the next day, and I went to it. And when I came out of the meeting, he was sitting in the parking lot waiting for me, and he was, like, so hyped, you know. And I came out, and he says, what do you think? You know, and I said, oh. I said, man, those are some sick people in there, you know. I said, if that is your AA, I don't want any part of it. It happened to be a women's meeting. I said, that's a sick bunch of women in there, you know. And he gave me some really wise counsel at that point. He gave me a meeting list, and there were a lot of meetings around. He gave me the meeting list, and he said, just try going to these. Go to these meetings, and if you don't find something that you like or you're comfortable with, you know, then let's talk again. Well, as it so happened, you know, the next meeting started to be more comfortable, and the next meeting started to be more comfortable, and soon enough, it took me about 6 months to find a home group, but I found my home group that's still my home group today. And, you know, life started to change because you guys started to help me change. And I wanted to be so much a part of that group. I wanted so much to have what those people in that group had. I mean, you know, you look at them and they laugh and they were like hearty and they were good and they were generous and, you know, they were like us in recovery. And I wanted so much to be a part of that. And it seemed like the people that had been in that group for a long time, all of them had a job that they did. I didn't realize that they rotated those jobs, but they had jobs. And they were all, they talked about service a lot and being a part of, and I so much wanted to do that. And so I went to this one guy in the group, and I asked him, I said, I want a job. I mean, I was still way shaky. And so he gave me a job, and he told me that my job, my service job, and my commitment needed to be to go into that meeting room and sit in the same chair every week, every Monday night at 8:30, and be hope. That was my job. I didn't have to do anything else. I just had to show up every week and sit in that chair so that if somebody new came through the door, they'd see some stability. Be stable. But they would see that the same person was there every week and that this deal worked. And so that was my job. And, you know, what a deal that was. And at the time, I didn't get it. At the time, I just almost felt like the dunce that they put in the corner. You know, yeah, you take your hat, you go sit over there, you know, that's your job. You know, but that wasn't what it was. You know, it truly was a gift. And they used to do this thing, they had home group meetings, and they held them away from the meeting. They were secret. And if you weren't a home group member, you didn't know what happened. It just showed up like in the format of the meeting. And I didn't get any of that. All I knew was they went somewhere that I wasn't supposed to go without me. And so this one time they were having a meeting at the GSR's home, or he was a DCM at the time, I can't remember. But anyway, we went over to his house, and I had two reasons for going there. One was because it was someplace I wasn't allowed to go. And the other was because there was this guy, and I'd noticed him in the meeting. And he was the incoming GSR, which I didn't know what that was, but I followed him to the meeting because then I'd get to know what happened. And I walked in, and this guy whose house it was at said, "What are you doing here?" And I said, you know, in all my intelligence and bright, quick wit. And he said, "Are you a home group member?" And I said, "No." He said, "You want to be?" "Well, yeah." He says, "Okay, come on in, have a cup of coffee." You know, it's kind of like the same kind of deal you guys do in meetings when we get to go there, you know. Anyway, so I went into this meeting and I have no clue what they were talking about, you know, and it doesn't really matter today. But I knew at that moment that I was a part of. I got to be a part of that group, and they started letting me do stuff like we used real coffee cups. We still do. At that time, we did real coffee cups and ashtrays and stuff, and I got to go wash them. And, you know, you can get so much motion out of a newcomer. If you get them, you get the coffee cups, you get them in a sink of water, and they're still shaky, there's all kinds of agitation shit going on there, you know. Anyway, so, you know, we're useful. We are very useful to have around. And but those guys really, they just helped me, and I found my sponsor in that group. And I listened to her share it at her 10th birthday. And I thought, oh, that woman has what I want. I'm going to ask her to be my sponsor. So I did. Went up after the meeting and I said, "Would you please be my sponsor?" And she said, "Sure." And she gave me her number, you know. And a year later I went when she celebrated 11 years. Now I was still going to the meeting in between. I just didn't talk to her, you know. And I went when she celebrated her 11 years and I said, "Oh, would you be my sponsor?" And she said, "Sure." And she gave me her number. And I'm not quick, you know. But when she celebrated 12 years, I went up and asked her if she'd be my sponsor. And she took my number, and she called me, you know. And I was so afraid. I was so afraid. You know, when George was talking about read through the steps and then you can go back and work them when you get ready, I was so afraid to start the steps because I knew that there was a fourth and fifth step coming up. And if I didn't start them, if I didn't do those first steps, I didn't have to do that fourth and fifth step. I mean, I got that much. And so I wasn't going to do it. I was filled with fear. And I happened to be over to her house one day because she called me and told me to come to her house that day. Anyway, happened to be there, and she turned to me and she said, "What is it that you're so afraid to tell me?" And I just, bloop, it just came out. I just told her what it was. I had this big, deep, dark, ugly secret that I knew I couldn't share with another human being. Something that I had done in my life that was so big and so ugly and so private that I couldn't share it, and it was eating me alive. And it was keeping me, even though I wasn't drinking, it was keeping me from being sober. And I shared it with her, and she said, "Oh, okay, and we talked about it, and she didn't run from the room, and she didn't shoot me out of her house with her shotgun. She didn't do any of that stuff. She just sat there and listened to me and loved me. You know, one of the miracles that happened for me over time and within a few years after that was there have been so many times that so many women in the program have shared with me and talked with me, and they've had that very, very, very same big, ugly thing that they did that they could not share with another living human being. And they are so fear-based that they can't get or stay sober. And what a gift to be able to now share that with another woman one-to-one. You know, I just can't believe how that miracle really does happen. How we can work those steps and get to a place where, you know, once we've cleaned that slate, once we've done all the amends that we can make, we have the ability to give that and share that with somebody else that maybe they can get to use those same tools and do those same things. You know, I truly believe that this is a God-given deal. God. Like lots of folks in this program, you know, that word God was just a terrifying thing to me. And it wasn't that I was against any religion. I just didn't have one. I didn't need one, thank you very much. I didn't need God, thank you very much. You know, and life was just going on. And I was under the belief that life just happened. You know, there wasn't any kind of divine intervention happening anywhere. Stuff just happened. But when I got here, you guys told me that I had to have God. I had to have, at least, a power greater than myself. And back in Salt Lake, and I haven't heard it for a long time, but in the mid-80s and stuff, there was this deal about, you know, you can choose this coffee cup to be your higher power, you know, or that doorknob to be your higher power, or that tree to be your higher power. You can choose anything. And I got to tell you, you guys sounded a little wacky to me, you know. I mean, I didn't have a God, but this cup was not going to keep me sober. It may keep me drinking coffee, but it was not going to keep me sober. And I happened to be in a lunch meeting, and there was this guy in there. His name was Charlie. He was a nice old guy, a little quirky. Had a microphone in his car and his little Corvair and a speaker on the outside that he used to drive down the road and talk to people. You know, he was a little odd, but you know, he was sober and had been for a long time. So anyway, he was in that meeting that day, and he shared with me, because somebody started off on this coffee cup thing, and I was irritated, you know. It's like, I'm here for an answer. I'm here for a solution. You're giving me this crap, you know. And what he shared with me was so simple, and I know it's in our book, and I know it's in all of our meetings. I just didn't hear it till that day. But what he said to me was, Shirley, if you come into this room, and there's you, and we add one other alcoholic, there's more than you. And if we add another, that's even more than you, and you have a power greater than yourself. And what you can't do by yourself, we can do together. And I got it. You know, I got that that's what my higher power could be, was the program and the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know without a doubt that I can absolutely trust my life completely to the groups of people in Alcoholics Anonymous. Clarification on that. I know without a doubt, maybe not all of the people in that group could I trust my life or my sobriety to, because we're still, a lot of us are still real sick. Some of us aren't here for the right reasons. Some of us aren't here to stay sober. Some of us are here to use people. Some of us are here for a whole lot of reasons. But you get us all collectively together, and I can trust you guys completely with my life. And you've kept me sober. And you've given me stuff to do. And you've, you know, past sitting in that chair, past being doing the washing the coffee cups, they let me be a GSR. You know, I got to be a DCM in the general service structure. I got to serve as chairman of our area and stand up there in front of the meetings, area meetings, and try to do what you guys told me to do, which is lead a meeting and follow the guidelines that the area had set up. Somebody laughingly said to me once, boy, that's going to be a big job for you trying to get all those alcoholics to do what you want. And I laughed. If you've ever been in an area service meeting, you know that doesn't happen. And fortunately, I've been sober enough for a while to know that that wasn't what my job was anyway. It wasn't to get them to do what I wanted. It was to get them to do what they said they wanted to do, you know, and that worked out real well once you take the pressure off, you know. But in 2001, I was, there's a couple of tie-ins to that number. I was 51 that year, but I was elected and had the honor of serving the Utah area as the panel 51 delegate to the General Service Conference. And I got to tell you, you guys trusted me to do that too. And you taught me enough that I think at that time I was as capable of accepting that trust for you as you were capable of accepting the trust for my sobriety when I first got here. You know, it came around, and it was another way that I got to pay that back, you know, because we've got to do this whole deal absolutely, totally, and completely together, because I can't stay sober by myself. And when I started to talk, I said, you know, my life today is wonderful, and it is. I mean, you know, I get to smile and laugh most every day. I don't have to put myself in harm's way. I don't hang out with angry people. If there's someone who's an angry person that hasn't dealt with all that stuff, if it's a woman, I'll work with her. If it's a man, I'm out of there. I have no need to have that kind of conflict in my life. Certainly try and get them, if they're willing to work on themselves, to go talk to another alcoholic man. But I just don't pick the people in my life anymore the way I picked them then. And I've had some absolutely great and tremendous friends in sobriety, and still have them today. And there's lots of them in this room today. And that's one of the things that makes it kind of comfortable. You know, when I was sitting there next to Harris, absolutely terrified. I was absolutely terrified to get up here. And he reached over. Yeah, he reached over, and he opened his book, and he was when they were reading the steps, and he pointed the word alcohol. That's what it's all about. You know, recovery from that. Oh, okay, I get it. I get to get up and talk about recovery from alcoholism. Can't get a whole lot simpler than that. I'm going to close with something out of this big book, and it has come to be my favorite part of the book, other than the first 164 pages that tells us, you know, lays out the blueprint, if you will, for sobriety. The reason this became so important to me is one of the things I said earlier. I have a host of friends. You know, I have so many people in AA that I absolutely just love. And, you know, sometimes we meet somebody and there's like that bond. It happens like that fast, you know, and we get to track each other around through sobriety and through life. And you teach me how to live, how I see you walk through a problem in your life and I get to walk through it and I know how because you showed me how. And you get a success in your life and I see you how to walk through it. And so I know how to walk through success in my life, which sometimes is scarier than walking through the problems. You know, but we learn all that stuff from each other. And there's this absolutely wonderful woman that I met a few years ago when she first came into the program. And she's since passed away. But she shared with me her favorite part of the book. And one of the gifts that she gave me happened the night before she passed away. And we'd gone up to see her and she wanted me to read her her favorite part of the book. And I'd forgotten my book. I left it home. I was just so crushed because it was obvious that it was like we were at the end, you know. And so I went home and we set a time. I was going to call her at 7 o'clock when I got home. And I got my book and I read the part to her out of the book. And the only sound on the other end of the line was she said, I love you. And I got to say, I love you back. And what a gift, you know. And so I like this because it kind of ties together for me what life is today. And it's out of a story in the book called Keys of the Kingdom. And I'll start with the part where she started reading, which is, AA is not a plan for recovery that can be finished and done with. It is a way of life, and a challenge contained in its principles is great enough to keep any human being striving for as long as he lives. We do not, cannot, outgrow this plan. As arrested alcoholics, we must have a program for living that allows for a limitless expansion. Keeping one foot in front of the other is essential for maintaining our arrestment. Others may idle in a progressive groove without too much danger, but retrogression can spell death for us. However, this isn't as rough as it sounds, as we do become grateful for the necessity that makes us toe the line. For we find that we are more than compensated for a consistent effort by the countless dividends we receive. A complete change takes place in our approach to life. Where we used to run from responsibility, we find ourselves accepting it with gratitude that we can successfully shoulder it. Instead of wanting to escape some perplexing problem, we experience a thrill of the challenge and the opportunity it affords for another application of AA techniques, and we find ourselves tackling it with surprising vigor. The last 15 years of my life have been rich and meaningful. I've had my share of problems, heartaches, and disappointments, because that is life. But also, I've known a great deal of joy and a peace that is the handmaiden of our inner freedom. I have a wealth of friends, and with my AA friends, an unusual quality of fellowship. For to these people, I am truly related. First, through pain and despair, and later through mutual objectives and a newfound faith and hope. And as the years go by, working together, sharing our experiences with one another, and also sharing a mutual trust, understanding, and love, without strings, without obligation, we acquire relationships that are unique and priceless. There is no more aloneness with that ache so deep in the heart of every alcoholic that nothing before could ever reach it. That ache is gone and never need return again. Now there is a sense of belonging, of being wanted and needed and loved. In return for a bottle and a hangover, we have been given the keys of the kingdom. Thank you.